From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the poet, April Ossman, whose new collection is Event Boundaries, published by Four Way Books. April Ossman is the author of Anxious Music as well, also from Four Way Books, and she's a recipient of the 2013 Vermont Arts Council Creation Grant and Prairie Schooner Reader's Choice Award. She has published her poetry widely in journals including Colorado Review and New England Review, and in anthologies including From the Fish House. She has published essays including Thinking Like an Editor, How to Order Your Poetry Manuscript, and a biography, Critical Study of Poet Linda Hull in American Writers Supplement 21. Former executive director of Alice James Books from 2000 to 2008, she owns a poetry consulting business offering manuscript editing and publishing advice to poets. She is an editor in residence for the Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing program at Sierra Nevada College and teaches private tutorials and poetry workshops using a method she developed to teach poets to revise their work objectively. She lives in West Windsor, Vermont. Her new collection, Event Boundaries, considers ways our relationships and growth as individuals are interdependent, whether it's possible to consider any relationship, including with ourselves, independent of the culture and environment it exists in, whether we create our culture and environment in part through the way we enact our relationships, to what degree reality is objective or a matter of perception, and how we come to terms with our and others' mortality. During the interview, April Ossman reads poems from Event Boundaries with permission from Four Way Books, copyright 2017, all rights reserved. We began our conversation by my asking April to read the poem titled Stubborn, and we take it from there. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Stubborn. I know it'll be hard after the blizzard. But don't ponder it. You can't if you plan to act. Where would Hercules, Ulysses, or any heroes be if they'd thought? Take Superman. Could he have flown? So I'm stuck, hip deep and rabid, talking myself out from where the plow left gray-flecked snowbanked, too deep for me. Calm down. Lift one ski, then the other. Soon I'm in a rhythm. Not easy. But any rhythm's easier than breaking stride. I've had relationships like that, tight as outgrown shoes. So it's not fun, but a challenge I can't resist. White pines, loaded with snow, threaten, creaking in wind, but I pretend not to hear. Only half my usual distance, but I turn homeward, sweat-soaked, creeped out by the doomsday yellow overcast. It occurs to me I could die lying under a blank birch gone blanker with snow, though I can't picture it. Like most, I'd like to go sleeping, but forecast drama, plane crash, earthquake, something with explosions and companions or an audience, something unlike these deserted woods drifted white, June deep already at midwinter. Will I finally get my fill of snow? I moved here for it. In every winter, I'm disappointed. It's never like novels, where flakes keep falling till people are bored, scared, or homicidal. It seems I like my thrills at home. Alcoholic, depressed, bipolar? Send them over. No job too tough for this little prairie dog. Like Laura, in the long winter, I'm the latest in a long line of headstrong women. Square-jawed and stubborn, convinced we'll win through to spring.
I love that. And I love that you mentioned Laura Ingalls Wilder. You know what? Why do we not see more of her referred to in works of literature? We all grew up reading her.
or those of us of a certain age did.
Well, yeah, but those books were written, when were they written? That's kind of turn of the century kind of stuff, right? When was she writing?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I think a lot of people read her. So anyway, I loved this.
They're classics, right?
Yeah, that's so good. I enjoyed, one thing I really enjoyed about this poem is the narrator, I'll say narrator, talking to herself, and there's an I and an implied you, who is also the I. And then later there's a reference to an audience, but in the case of this poem, the audience is the I and the you and the I. You know what I mean? I loved that play of who's being spoken to.
Thank you.
I've had that.
It's one of my steeped in Vermont poems.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I've had that experience of being hip deep in snow and panicking. It's not easy to get yourself to talk yourself down. So let's see another little word play that I loved. The doomsday yellow overcast is a lovely line, and then there's forecast drama. So that was fun too.
I love that you noticed that. Wordplay is one of my besetting sins or loves or both. I can't resist it in my work.
Yeah, it's really fun. Well, and I think because Doomsday Yellow Overcast is so evocative, it really does, like, you can just picture that sky. So because that kind of jumped out at me, it was right there top of mind when I got to forecast drama. And then when you describe the forecast drama, it reminded me of the Weather Channel and how forecasts have also started to include these kinds of dramas.
Yeah, actually, I have a poem in this book about that, Training for the Apocalypse.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you know, which I wrote out of just, oh, for heaven's sakes, you know, like, this is ridiculous. Like, let's get hysterical about yet another snowstorm in Vermont, you know, which, of course, it's a daily occurrence here.
It is. And now we name storms, not just hurricanes. And, you know, pretty soon we'll start to name, you know, the sprinkle at 4 p.m. Anyway, yeah, I enjoyed this poem a lot. And the whole idea of just coming from a long line of stubborn women, I think, is nice at the beginning of this collection. It sort of establishes a tone that was, I thought, apt.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's my sort of subtle feminism. And I mean, I don't know that I have much that's overt, but it's sort of in there. And of course, I actually really do come from a long line of stubborn women, and it continues. My niece and her daughter now, which is my grandniece, so, you know, continuing the tradition.
Yeah. Now, you're not from Vermont, so you're not a stubborn Vermonter originally. Where are you from?
California.
Oh.
I was born in Santa Barbara, and I fell in love with Robert Frost's poetry when I was 10 years old and read his biography. You know, they used to have this series of biographies of famous people for kids. And I just decided that I was going to move to Vermont and be a poet when I grew up. And so I did.
So how long did that take?
Gosh, I left California when I was 25.
Okay.
So, yeah, I bought a little Toyota pickup truck with a camper shell, and I packed up all my stuff and I drove across the country, and I had never actually been in Vermont. but it was like coming home. It just felt right, you know. I loved the four seasons, and you know, in California you really have two seasons, rain and not rain. and I just, you know, the culture is different here, and more trees and fewer people, and no pollution, at least not compared to California, and you know, we have a water surplus here.
Right, isn't that weird?
Yeah.
You know, every once in a while, I get grouched at by somebody because, you know, maybe I've let the water run too long. Actually, my nephew from California came to visit, and he came bounding over, you know, to the kitchen sink to turn off the water. He was so annoyed with me, and I'm like, look, I'm sorry, but we really don't have a water shortage here. I'd love to send it west, but I don't think I can.
As far as I know, it just goes back in to join the groundwater, and, you know.
Right, right, exactly.
Plenty of it.
So now, what part of Vermont do you live in, April?
I live in West Windsor.
Okay.
Which I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's about a 25-30 minute drive from Hanover, New Hampshire.
Okay.
So it's part of what they call the Upper Valley. So, you know, not too far from White River Junction and Hartford and Heartland. And
Right. Yeah, I think I did notice that you teach sometimes in White River. I taught a workshop down there one time. I'm trying to remember the name of the place that I taught at. It wasn't a poetry center. It was some other...
The Writers' Center?
It might be the Writers' Center. I think that's right.
Yeah. Joni Cole is one of the founders of that.
Okay.
Susan Stewart Taylor, I think, is the other one.
Yeah, it was a nice space. I had a nice turnout, too. It was fun.
Yeah, it's a great space. Still going on. I haven't taught a workshop there in quite a while. The last few years, I've just been so busy with the editing that really all of the workshops I've taught have been ones where I get invited to travel somewhere and teach one. And, you know, I taught one in California a couple of weeks ago, and I actually taught one in Middlebury, Vermont last weekend.
Oh, wow. Now, where in Middlebury?
At the Swift House.
Oh, yeah.
It was, I was invited by the Vermont Poetry Society.
Oh, the Swift House.
And they held event at the Swift House.
That's a lovely spot. Now you mentioned your editing, so that's your freelance editing work.
Yeah, I do that full time actually.
Okay.
I edit poetry full time from the comfort of my home office.
Now, do you tend to have most of your clients through publishers, or do you tend to get individuals who want help with their editing and then maybe help finding a publisher?
Yeah, the latter. People come to me. It's rare that I do work directly for a publisher.
Okay.
Usually, almost all the time, it's, you know, poets who hire me, and most of them are hoping to, you know, get their manuscript published, to get it in shape, to submit, and, you know, have a better chance of being accepted. Occasionally, I have had a poet who wanted me to edit. You know, they had a publisher, but they wanted me to help them do a final edit before they submitted it to their publisher.
Right. Okay.
But mostly it's poets who are looking for a publisher. And I don't act as an agent, you know, but I do, you know, I edit the manuscript and I will generally suggest some publishers that I think might be good fits for them to kind of get them going.
Okay.
But I don't act as an agent because there's no money in poetry for an agent to live off.
Well, let's see. Why don't we read another poem? You, if I may ask, why don't you read another poem? I think that the next one we were gonna discuss was The Terror of Doors.
Yeah. Okay. The Terror of Doors. No one considers the door's terror, held so tenuously by such flimsy hinges, longing for an axis so awe-inspiring only its God could open it. Avoiding endless submission to the careful and careless alike. The sideways, swinging fall as the universe shoulders in, slamming the door against the wall. Doors want to stay in a frame's familiar embrace, though one rebel, slanted and swelled, refusing the fit, preferring to stay where its bottom found a seat on the equally unruly floor, an querulous door, sometimes bangs so deliberately in unperceived breezes as to unnerve its owners with seeming agency, an urge to escape its fate and go winging off after something unimaginable in space, the knob turned beak or aeronautical control stick to steer past stars, the frame abandoned to examine its navel, and the wall, never elated by the hole put in it, now a toothless mouse, a rectangular O of awe or terror as the gods of chance advance.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, I don't always ask what was the inspiration for a certain poem, but this one I need to ask. Like, how did this come to you? What was your initial spark for this?
I'm so glad you asked. It was actually 9/11. This is my 9/11 poem.
Really?
Poem. Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that struck me early on that I don't know that it struck a lot of people was just sort of like, oh, boy. you know, this has happened and it's terrible and all of that. But, you know, this is going to be an excuse to, you know, offer to take away more of our rights in exchange for security. And there was just this sort of whole culture, it felt like to me, that developed post 9/11 of kind of this kind of terror hysteria where, you know, the news got progressively more hysterical. And I feel it's still going on now. And, you know, everything's an emergency, everything's urgent, and we should be afraid of everything. And,
yeah.
And so this is sort of my, all right, you know, let's look at, you know, being afraid.
Yeah.
And how that serves us or doesn't. And you know, I don't actually remember how the business of the door, you know, how that sparked, you know, but in the 9/11 sort of post, you know, hysterical reporting was, you know, what sparked it. And I can't remember how I came up with that particular metaphor.
Yeah.
But I know doors, you know, are one of those things that I've sort of thought about some in this book.
Yeah. Now that's interesting. So, and that brings us back to why I think the Weather Channel now is trying to frighten people, because it's good for the tone of the times, post 9/11.
Revenue,
yeah. And now actually looking at the poem with this new context, I'm looking at the word axis. And that's a word that really became very, very popular after 9/11, the axis of evil. I hadn't thought about that. Was that part of why you put that word in there? Or?
You know, that is one of those I think I have to thank the unconscious part of my brain for. And you know, when I write, I feel that, you know, there are two parts of my brain contributing. There's sort of the forebrain that thinks it's smart and thinks it's in charge. And then there's this kind of unconscious contribution that happens, you know, where maybe you have a particular subject or theme in mind. And I just try to keep that on the periphery while I focus on, you know, describing the metaphor in detail and let that unconscious part of my brain work its magic. And Axis, I think, kind of came out of that place.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I think it can be so much fun to anthropomorphize. And I didn't really ever think of it until I read this, but doors are very, they have a lot of personality, or they have a lot of behavior that could be attributed to personality and character, you know, like the querulous door, the unruly floor, you know, the one that's preferring to stay where its bottom found a seat. That was really fun.
Well, you know, that came out of living in old houses in Vermont,
right,
where I'm sure you know, like, there are no right angles after a certain number of decades.
Right.
You know, you put a marble on the floor and it rolls to one end of the room.
Right. You only have to worry if it rolls back the next day. yeah. And I loved the line, the universe shoulders in. You know, on TV, we always see people shouldering into doors. So that was fun, too. Is this written to any certain form? I must admit, I don't know my forms as well as I should. But the rhymes kind of popped up here and there. And I thought, wait, I wonder, is there a form to this?
It's free verse, so I'm basically making up my own rules, but I do use a fair amount of rhyme and half rhyme, and most of it's internal. I don't do much end rhyme. You know, I like to have maybe, you know, the rhyme come, maybe one of the rhymes is at the end and one's in the middle, or they're both in the middle, or one's at the beginning of the, you know, line and one's in the end or the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I do use a lot of rhyme, and some of that is conscious, and some of that, you know, I'm so practiced at this point, you know, that some of that's kind of on autopilot.
Yeah.
And then when I revise, you know, sometimes I'll go back and add more rhymes. I'll think, oh, I could, you know, I could put a word there that, you know, is more evocative and has rhyme or half rhyme. But a fair amount of that now happens just kind of on autopilot.
Yeah. Now, the last phrase in this poem is, as the gods of chance advance. And that just made me happy. I don't know. That, like, really brought it home.
I'm so glad.
I don't know. I feel like a well-placed rhyme kind of makes you go, ooh, you know, I want to reexamine that. And it's fun.
Oh, that's really well put. And I like, you know, it's funny. It's a delicate balance, I feel, because sometimes, you know, you can do a rhyme that's kind of too cute, too clever, and kind of draws too much attention to itself. you know, versus doing what you just described, which would be more of the aim. But it, yeah, you know, hopefully it sort of packs kind of a punch.
Yeah, and I think that the too cute rhyme or the complete rhyme, you know, almost like limerick, is what a lot of people think of poetry as being, which is too bad, really.
Yeah, yeah, that's an age that I don't say it's entirely past, but, you know, perfect end rhyme is really hard to get away with now. It's just, it's a bygone idiom. And it wouldn't surprise me if it came back at some point, but I imagine it would be in a slightly different form.
Now, Robert Frost did a lot of that, though, right?
Yeah, and he did it really skillfully.
Really brilliantly, yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, how shall we look at another one? Your next one that we discussed is Hearing That Music.
Okay. Hearing That Music. The song I think of as my shower song isn't mine, but his, extolling the wisdom of living in the present, accompanied by synthesized orchestral music, the kind of melody attending a lyrical foray into the past, countered by chords charging the future, a song triangled by anticipation, fulfillment, regret, the sweet, elaborate stasis he lives for, the moment I can't tolerate before decision, when he feels rich with choices, so many, only all or none could be correct. He's played it so often, he knows I'll protest if he plays it again. So he listens while I shower. Though he's away, I hear it now and stop the water, pausing, half-rinsed and shivering to hear the call more clearly.
Yeah, thank you. Another one that just, I loved this one. I loved the kind of push and pull of what is missed. Do you know what I mean? There's both a sort of not wanting to hear the song and also stopping the water to hear the song or to hear if he's still there. I kind of loved that. That not neatly tied up emotion.
Yes, characteristic of the relationship. You probably noticed I write a lot about romantic relationships.
You do, yeah. And there is a push and pull there. It's funny, there's another poem you're going to read later called Peak that sort of makes a nice little mention of how, well, we'll talk about that when we get there. But anyway, yeah, I was going to ask you about writing sort of love poems, but they're a little bit conflicted love poems sometimes.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in my first book, Anxious Music, too. Less so in the book I'm working on now. Actually, maybe none in the book I'm working on now. But yeah, it's funny. You know, I have this theory that, you know, we all have, you know, issues to work out in our lives. And I think, you know, some of us work out our issues more in a work environment, or some maybe in family relationships. And it seems to me that the place where, you know, I've really had to learn my lessons, whether I wanted to or not, was in romantic relationships. So that, you know, lessons I needed to learn, like, oh, detachment. You know? It was romantic relationships. It's sort of like, put that in my face, like, okay, either you learn this or you're never going to have peace of mind in a relationship. So yeah, I think that's, you know, why I write about those relationships so much. I mean, as it happens now, I'm in a relationship with someone that I've been in a relationship with for about 18 years, and it's going really well, but it was a long journey to get there.
Yeah.
And when you find yourself in, you know, serial relationships with the same issues coming up, you know, to me, that's sort of, you know, like, okay, apparently you're being stubborn and not, you know, resisting a lesson here. And so, you know, poetry is one of the places where I've kind of tried to work that out.
Yeah. That's interesting. Another thing I really loved in here, and I think this sort of works well with what we're talking about, is a lot about the lines in this poem sort of defy expectation, which I think is a nice, very subtle metaphor for how hard it can be to work through relationship. So some of the lines I'm talking about are, my shower song is his. His sweet stasis, I can't tolerate. It's sweet, and yet I can't tolerate. all or none could be correct. He's away, I hear it now. So it's the absence that's being heard. And then, of course, stopping the water to hear more clearly. I don't know. I thought all of these were sort of moments that, you know, pushed against each other a little bit.
Yeah, I work with paradox a lot work. Yeah, and I think, you know, that's partly because I feel like paradox is so much a part of my life and probably most people's lives, you know. I don't know if everybody thinks of it that way, but it's sort of, you know, there's so many of the truths that, you know, you finally learned seem to be sort of centered in that. Like, you know, you can't have what you really want in a relationship until you let go of wanting it, and then you can have all you want to have. I don't know why that's true, but it's proven to be.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Now, one more thing that you do in this is you just very briefly, but I'm really always very interested in people who try to describe music, which I think is a hard thing to do. And you very briefly describe this music a little bit. And I wondered, were you describing a certain song? It sounds like yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it was from, the group The Human League and an album called Octopus. And the song, I had written it down somewhere in case you asked, and I have forgotten now what it was.
Human League. I remember that band. Did they do Don't You Want Me, or is that somebody else?
Yes, with the waitress in the cocktail bar.
Okay. I remember that band.
This song was a different song, though. Octopus is a later album.
Okay.
And, God, he used to play it over and over and over until I thought I was going to scream.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, so I thought you did a good job of describing. It didn't need to describe a certain song. I wasn't sitting here trying to figure out the song, but I got a feeling for it. You know, the synthesized orchestral music, the kind of melody attending a lyrical foray into the past. You know, and then you talk about the chords. I don't know. It was. I thought it was a nice description of music. Sometimes I think it's so hard to do.
Thank you. Yeah, I've actually, you know, music was a fairly strong leitmotif in anxious music, and I find it creeps into my poetry, and I don't know, maybe I was a frustrated musician in a past life or something. I'm not sure why that is. And of course, my partner is a retired musician, so, you know, music is sort of ever-present in our lives.
Right, right.
Maybe that's why.
What is your partner's instrument, or is it?
He plays, or used to play anyway, the guitar, bass, and electric and acoustic, both.
Wow, okay. Okay.
So he was in bands for a lot of years, and now he works at Dartmouth College. And he does video conferencing.
Which probably isn't as much fun, but has better insurance.
Yep.
So I don't think that any of the poems we're discussing today do this, but I did have a question for you about when poetry is after someone. So what is that? Is that an attempt to imitate another poet, or a sort of respectful nod in the direction of what somebody else is doing?
Most times when, you know, a poet puts after another poet, it's sort of acknowledging the inspiration of, you know, a particular poet, or often a particular poet's a poem by a particular poet.
Okay.
There's a poem, I have one of those in Anxious Music that's after Mark Halliday, and the poem is written in the style of some persona poems in one of his books, a book called Tasker Street. And so I sort of wrote the poem in that style. So I wrote after Mark Halliday to kind of acknowledge the influence. Like, I didn't steal any of his lines or anything
right,
like
right,
that.
Right.
You know, that the style was sort of, you know, after what he did.
Yeah. Now, is it ever a very huge departure from you when you will do something like that? Like, you had one in here, and I looked the poet up, and she's a slam poet, and I wondered if you, Jean Verley?
So, oh, yeah.
So do you ever do slam stuff, or is that a bit of a departure for you?
That would be a departure for me. I haven't done that, but actually the reason it's after her, and actually I have a couple of poems that are after Gwendolyn Brooks, too.
Right.
And those are... Two of those three poems are Golden Shovel poems, which is a form invented by the poet Terence Hayes, mm-hmm. where he took a line by the poet Gwendolyn Brooks, and then you write the line vertically down the right-hand column. So, you know, let's say the line is, "I think it must be lonely to be God." Which is one, that's one of my poems in here, Celestial Solo or Divine Funk. And so at the end of what will be the first line, it's I, and then the next line is think, and then the next line is it, right?
Yes,
and
yes,
then you
yes.
have to like write lines to fill in, but you know what the last word in each line is going to be. And it's a really wonderful kind of prompt to, for some reason, it reaches directly into the subconscious or unconscious and pulls out all kinds of cool stuff. And, Where the Wolves Are started out being a golden shovel after a line by Jean Verlet. But that poem, it didn't work in that form. So I ended up, you know, altering the line breaks and changing it around.
Okay.
Which still makes it
a good prompt, even if you end up with something else that you like.
Yeah, yeah. So so I put after her to acknowledge that, you know, I stole one of her lines.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Let's read another one. The next one is called His Mother's Hair. And this one to me was really, it told this incredibly sweet, sort of sad story. I really liked it. Do you mind reading that one next?
Yeah. His Mother's Hair. The last time he cut his mother's hair, the rude morning sun left no corner of her kitchen private. The light surgically clean where it fell on his scissors. Her hair fell in a blonde circle on the lake blue tile. Smell of coffee and cinnamon. Her laughing shook her head. "Hold still," he said, his hand surfeit with the curl and softness of her hair. 3 weeks after her death, a stranger entered the salon and settled in the chair. She had the color and shape of his mother's hair, and when he sunk his hands in it, the texture, even cowlicks, individual as freckles, same. Twice he had to leave the room, and twice he returned. Still, when he touched her hair, it blurred. "Hold still," he said. "Hold still."
That is just such a beautiful poem, and it really, it touched me. I found it very poignant.
Thank you. Yeah, that poem is actually based on a real event. I had a hairdresser a long time ago, in my 20s, who his mother really died, and he had told the story of, you know, this woman coming to have her hair cut that had hair just like his mother's. And I was so touched by the story, I had to write a poem about it. And so the first part of the poem I made up completely, just imagining like maybe the last time he cut his mother's hair,
right.
So I could tell the story of, you know, what happened when the person came into the salon.
Yeah. It was interesting to me. Well, first of all, the beautiful line, "Hold still," which of course has more than just the meaning of sitting in the chair. I loved that you ended with that. You know, I felt like his regret and sadness has more, you know, to do with don't go, you know, don't move, don't go. Let's hold this right here. And I thought that was so beautiful. Am I over analyzing?
Oh, that's exactly what I meant. And I have to say, it's really hard to end a poem with dialogue or with direct speech.
Yeah.
I'm always, you know, suggesting that poets edit out because so much of the time when poets use dialogue, you know, they put something that somebody actually said, even if it isn't very interesting or very evocative.
Right. You
know? Like, yeah. if you're going to use speech or dialogue in a poem, it should be pithy. It should be evocative. It should grab you by the shirt front, right? So I don't do it often because it's hard to do well.
Right.
It's also a way of kind of handling the fact that he's crying, right? And that's something else that's really hard to write about in any kind of creative writing, is somebody's crying. And, you know, to not have it feel melodramatic or sentimental, it's tricky how you have to find a way to sort of phrase it so it doesn't come off that way.
Right. Let's see. Let me ask you, before we read any more poems, who might you have read lately that you really enjoyed? Whose work have you read, whether it's poetry or something else, that you might recommend to listeners?
Oh, okay. So the title of the book is The Hate You Give by Angie Thomas, which is a novel. It's a debut novel by a wonderful writer. And I have to say, it's just an amazing first book. I can't believe it. She's such a good writer already.
Wow.
But it deals with the main character, her best friend, a young African-American man, is unarmed, killed by the police. I thought the book would be really depressing, but it wasn't so much, I mean, other than the kind of the obvious, more of this, and it's awful, but... You know, it just really went into the life and the aftermath for the main character, and she was this wonderful, strong character, and she was inspiring, you know. So I really enjoyed it, and it was nice to be uplifted instead of depressed, despite, you know, the main event that happens, because most of what happened was afterward, and kind of how she went on with her life, and how she was haunted, and how she transcended, and
Wow, that's
so, yeah,
great.
The latest thing I've read is actually fiction.
Great. Okay. I'm going to have to look for that one. I haven't read that one. It sounds wonderful. You know, it's interesting. I love the idea that it's about this subject we are becoming sadly very familiar with again in the news. It seems perpetually in the news. But it sounds like she goes into the lives of the characters to make it more intimate, and so that we can learn this family's story or this community's story.
Yeah, exactly that.
How about we read another poem? You have one called Peak, which I love. Do you want to read that next?
Yeah. I don't want to say it's another misbegotten love poem, but certainly one with some struggle. Peak. The woodpecker isn't pecking wood. He's pecking the metal eave of my standing seam roof, making a racket that reverberates is echo, strutting his stuff for a female more peaked than I, or staking territory we disagree is his, an argument I've had with one or two of his human fellows. But who doesn't want to beat on something once in a while? Who doesn't miss metal trash can lids, the opportunity to perfect the perfect clamor? Take a bat, make some noise, give some ears what for, ring them inside out.
Thank you for reading that. I love the noise that the poem makes in describing the noise that this bird makes. You know, I think that the kind of alliteration, all the consonants and the vocabulary you choose. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, about sort of like reflecting the subject matter of a poem or the theme or a feeling in the language?
Yeah. So I use a lot of kind of hard consonants there.
Right.
You know, so that the language is almost kind of angry and noisy and, you know, to reflect that. And also what's called enjambment in poetry, right, where you break the line in a place where it's not necessarily a really natural place to pause, you know, the opportunity to perfect the perfect clamor, right?
Right.
That kind of leaves you hanging a little bit, that perfect, and it ends on a hard consonant. So it kind of, you know, contributes sonically to that kind of punching sound.
Yes.
And it's funny, you know, anger is something I feel like not a lot of poets write about, or maybe not as many as you might expect. You know? And so, you know, that's something else that I'm kind of doing here is, you know, just like writing anger, which doesn't happen all that much.
And should. I mean, that's a real bonding emotion for all of us. And yet I think poetry is supposed to be sort of lovely or melancholy or, I think you're right. Poetry should be a little angrier sometimes.
Yeah, and well, and, you know, as a society right now, it seems like there's so much anger.
Yes.
It's topical.
And the alliteration, too, I don't know why, but the alliteration felt like it was reflecting some of this peak. The Miss Metal, when it's Miss, who doesn't miss metal trash can lids, and standing seam and racket that reverberates, strutting his stuff. Maybe it's just drawing our attention to the sounds.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it does. And of course, alliteration is another one of those, you know, you can do too much of it. You know, if you have, for instance, a string of words that begin with the same consonant, you know, that can start to feel overdone.
Right.
You know, I find that I think alliteration works better when, you know, you're sometimes the repeated consonant is at the beginning of the word and sometimes in the middle. And, you know, I think repeating vowels tends to be a little more subtle. And I use a lot of that, but this was a poem that I think needed the consonants, the repetition of the consonants, because again, sort of getting to that kind of loud, angry noise.
Right, and actually, it's not fair the way that I just listed them all off because they don't sit together in the poem. There are pairs here and there. There's a great line from a movie called Broadcast News. Do you remember the movie Broadcast News?
Yeah, vaguely.
And I'm not going to remember the whole line, but there's like a very competent reporter is watching a sort of arrogant and less competent newsman. And he says, a lot of alliteration from anxious anchors. I can't remember. It's this great line. Okay, let's see. How about the mechanical home care bed?
Okay. The mechanical home care bed. An awkward, unbeautiful fairy, too big for the room it sailed in, whose slanting metal bars did nothing to keep the rough sea out, but appeared to keep my father in, clinging as he did to one with his too thin arm, and tilting his gaze to see around them such a transforming, grateful smile for an offering so small, such mundane conversation. The bed with its hanging trapeze, a sailing circus none of us wanted to witness, intended, they said, to assist in raising himself from the bed, though we knew the truth, a hangman's triangular noose dangling all those weeks over his weary head.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That one, yeah. I loved the metaphor of the fairy. And as I read, I realized that it was an extended metaphor. The rough sea, and even his gaze around the room is tilting. I enjoyed that metaphor continued on, even, I thought, fairly subtly. But that was such a perfect comparison to that big bed.
Thank you. I use extended metaphor a lot.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the more magical things you can do in a poem.
Yeah. Now this one, it's funny. I thought about along with his mother's hair, the way we write about our parents, but this one I think sounded more like it's closer to home. Is this perhaps your own father?
Yeah. My stepfather actually, but he brought me up.
Okay.
He died of cancer and, you know, it was a slow, rather agonizing process. And the last 6 weeks, maybe, I forget how long it was, you know, he was in this awful bed that just up the whole room. And, you know, the last time I saw him, I think, was 3 weeks before he died. Mm. And it, you know, that, and then, you know, he died, and I went back to California to be with my mom and help out. And, you know, we couldn't wait for that bed to be gone. The people that, you know, loan you the bed, they come pick it up quite promptly because, you know, presumably they need it for the next person.
But
I kind of couldn't wait for that to be out of there. It was kind of this huge symbol. And I actually wrote this poem like right after they took the bed away the same day, and which was just a few days after he died. And, you know, a lot of times you kind of have to wait a long time before you can write about something like that. But I just, like, it loomed so enormous in my mind. I had to do something with it.
Yeah, yeah. And
sat down on the bed and wrote the poem out.
It's, in a way, it's nice that they can bring that bed in and somebody can be at home, but it does make such a difference to what home is and what home looks like to have something so foreign sitting there.
Yeah, yeah, and it also, I think, maybe, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's kind of a harbinger. It's sort of like, you know, there's kind of a doom in that bed because they don't generally bring one of those into your home unless somebody's on their way out.
Yes.
So you know where they're going. So yeah, it was just really kind of a fraught symbol.
And then that triangular noose, that was really quite a metaphor right there too. It just dangling over, so sad. That's just hard to think about. And yet beautifully written and very vibrant. You know, I mean, I felt like I was in that room.
Yeah, yeah, and it's funny that the using the noose in that poem ended up being really eerie because,
yeah,
you know, my brother died, a year and a half later of suicide by hanging himself. And so, and I had used this noose image in this other poem.
Right.
And it was, you know, really sort of shivery, prophetic or something.
Yeah. Now, it's funny. I have a question that is about that other poem, which is called Suicide Lament. But I'll ask it now. Do you ever find that, I find that writing can be very helpful, very healing, but do you ever find that when the subject is so hard, the idea of writing a poem about it is, it's hard to approach it? Or
yeah, although it's funny, like the poems I wrote about my brother's suicide, those poems were sort of like I needed to write them.
Okay.
You know, to just deal with it. So I wouldn't say that, you know, they certainly, you know, they're meant to be art and not therapy, but, you know, I have to say that it felt really good to make something beautiful out of something so painful.
Yes.
So that for me is cathartic, that sort of that kind of transcendence and making art out of pain.
Sure.
To speak to what you had asked about, you know, it sometimes, you know, something is it like really impossible or feels impossible to write about. And it was actually that way with the first poem in the book, One Night, which deals with, you know, there being a fawn in the middle of the road, you know, driving and, you know, almost hitting it, not hitting it. And I wanted to write about that for the longest time, and I tried, and it was just awful. And that's one of those things that, you know, to write a poem about that and have it not be sentimental or melodramatic,
yes,
really challenging. And I think I ended up finally writing, you know, the poem that's in the book maybe a year or 2 years later. And I finally got kind of an inspiration about a way I could approach it that wouldn't be sentimental or melodramatic. But there would definitely be that risk, you know, with poems about suicide or rape or anything really highly emotionally charged like that.
I mean, yeah.
You need a metaphor or some other way of creating narrative emotional distance from the material so that you can make it art and not therapy.
Yeah, well, and I think too, and sadly we don't have time to read all of these poems, but I think another thing that went that worked really well is that the collection as a whole has a certain arc to it, and you have a poem at the end, near the end, called What Nature Did, that stands in contrast to the fawn of One Night, and it's again about a deer. This deer isn't as lucky as the fawn that you didn't hit. But I loved that at the beginning and at the end, we had these two different situations that kind of, I don't know, ground the collection in a kind of arc.
I love that you noticed that.
Oh, good.
Arc, yeah. You know, in the book that, you know, I intended to create a sort of, you know, beginning in a place of maybe some darkness and some struggle. And, you know, that first poem, I'm kind of throwing down the gauntlet, like, you know, you think this isn't serious, it's serious. But, and, you know, I sort of ordered the poems to kind of, to create a sense of emotional, spiritual evolution so that, you know, you feel like you're, you know, at the end of the book that you're in a different place from where you began, and that the two deer poems, you know, are kind of deliberate bookends, being in a different place with the deer. And so too, there's a poem early on called Scrim,
right,
that with mystery and being afraid of mystery. And then the final poem in the book is accepting mystery. In fact, the final word in the book is mystery.
Yeah.
Into the mystery, but you're okay with it.
Right. I was going to have you read the next poem we had talked about, but, you know, since we've just been discussing Suicide Lament, I wonder if we can read that one next, the poem about your brother.
Suicide Lament. Adrift on indifferent waves, blinded by fog so saturated, it beads and drips from every face. Afraid we'll hear behind the veil a chorus of regret for the misspent, a lament heaven of angels wailing for all they failed to save, an eternity of weeping interspersed by celestial music sung sotto voce to remind us of all we miss. Grief like an ocean, we're afraid we'll never reach the shore of, and no lifeboat sailing toward our veil.
Yeah, I loved that you titled it Suicide Lament, so that we aren't wondering in the early lines where it's going or what's happened. I feel like there's nothing coy about this poem. It presents a very real situation and emotion. And anyway, did you ever title it anything different?
I might have. If I went back to earlier drafts, I might have, but I actually don't remember that.
Yeah.
It had title early on, that's for sure.
Well, I like how it is titled now. So do you want to talk a little bit about the form of this poem? It's because people can't see the pages. I'll just mention that it's stanzas in two lines, each separated by space. Or maybe you can describe it better as a poet.
Yeah. So I think that there's a fair amount of white space, for sure. And also the lines are fairly strongly indented so that they're in couplets. So the first line is along the left margin, and the second line is indented quite a bit. And
right.
I do that sometimes more, sometimes less in poems. And this one, it's a more severe indenting because it feels to me a kind of an off-balance kind of a movement.
Yes.
Moving back and forth. And also the second line kind of undermines in terms of, like, structural support, if you were building something, you know, so the foundation isn't under the whole house, kind of, and there's this feeling of kind of precariousness,
right?
Visually, that I'm working to create, where it feels like kind of what you're standing on isn't solid, and it might slip out from underneath you.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad to have you describe that because I'm not sure I would have picked up on that, but it makes a lot of sense. Do you write by hand or do you write on a computer?
Most of the time on a computer.
Okay.
The only time I write by hand now is if I'm somewhere where I don't have a keyboard. So, you know, when I go hiking, I'll usually take, you know, something to write on and something to write with just in case I get struck by inspiration. And occasionally I'll be like, the last poem in the book, Oh Chicago, Oh Hare, I wrote on an airplane flying out of that airport. And I was reading a book and I got inspired. So I ended up scribbling that poem down on a piece of paper, you know, by longhand.
Yeah, yeah. That that airport always makes me think of the moving walkway is now ending. You're under all those lights. Okay. Well, thank you for talking about Suicide Lament, and it's a beautiful poem. Unfortunately, we're getting really low on time, so I don't want to miss the opportunity to hear your title poem, which is called Event Boundaries, and I wonder if you want to read that one and maybe tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. You know when you say you're in the living room and you walk into the kitchen and you can't remember what you intended to do in there?
Yes.
So we have a name for that now. When we go through an entrance or an exit, like a doorway, it's a signal to the unconscious to clear the decks for the next event.
Okay.
So psychologists have termed this event boundaries.
Oh.
Isn't that the coolest thing? I read an article about it in a magazine, and I was just fascinated by the poetic possibilities of that. Like, oh, if you went in and out of the door, you know, what could you remember or forget? And I actually wrote this poem while I was snowshoeing, and I didn't have a pen or a paper. So I wrote the entire poem in my head and memorized it. And, like, I couldn't wait to get back to the house so I could type it before I forgot it.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot to remember. I mean, it's a page and a half.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay, well, do you want to read that one?
Yeah. Event boundaries. Such a comfort to know it's temporary dementia. When I enter a room and forget why I came, to fetch a pen, to write a note, to remember the task my brain's just mislaid. I've only to pass back through the fogging doorway to reclaim a resolution or name. And conversely, a relief to think I won't have to live every future tick and talk of my anxious watch, recalling how distraught I was over anyone's death. I've only to stroll a doorframe's border to forget a particular grief, misbegotten love, or moral lapse to escape the rasp of conscience or self-flagellation, to visit the nations of remembrance or amnesia as I please.
Now hearing you read that poem, knowing what it's based on, it brought me a whole new appreciation for it. I didn't know about event boundaries, so that's great.
Yeah, and most people don't, and a lot of people, if they think they know what it means, they confuse it with event horizon.
Okay.
You know, which is the point at which the gravity of a black hole becomes irresistible and it sucks everything in, including light.
So, and the idea that you had to remember this until you got back to a piece of paper and a pen or a computer, that's perfect. You're lucky that it didn't all fly out of your head when you went through the door to go into your house.
Yes. Although I have a pretty good memory.
Oh, that's great. Now, one of the questions I had about this one was, I think early on in the poem, there's a sentence structure that sets up a kind of repetition of rhythm. And now I'm wondering if that was something that helped you remember the poem when you had to go write it down later.
You know, unconsciously, it probably did.
Mm.
Wasn't conscious.
All right.
Yeah. Again, sort of a magic part of the brain.
Yeah. Well, we are sadly out of time. So I just want to mention again that the name of the book is the same as that title poem, Event Boundaries, by April Osman, published by Four Way Books. April, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Vermont poet April Osman. You can learn more about her work at aprilosman.com, and that's spelled O-S-S-M-A-N-N. And on that website, you'll see information about her consultation business and about the workshop she offers that teaches poets to revise their work objectively. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, April Osman. It's about extended metaphor, which we discussed during the interview. April says it makes for magic in poems. Often poets use metaphor, but they drop it too soon and don't explore it deeply enough. But when you push it and continue describing using the metaphor, that's often when you get to a moment of epiphany or discovery and you realize something. The smarter part of your brain can then teach you something. Focus on describing in specific detail and keep the event or theme in the periphery of your brain as you write. It's a great exercise, says April. Pick something for a metaphor and maybe in that description write about something that wasn't as you expected it to be, or something that happened in a way other than how you expected it to happen. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream the show at 99.3wbtv.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Wherever you listen to the show, if you enjoy it, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tell all your friends. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.